Coming up on Tech Nation, it's our program on Nobel Prizes Explained 2015. A panel of esteemed professors has been brought together to explain it all, from the Nobel Peace Prize to the Prize for Literature, as well as physiology or medicine, physics, chemistry, and economics. Who better than university professors to explain it all? The challenge is to describe the work of each prize in everyday terms, as well as why that work was considered so important among all the human endeavor everywhere. The professors get the job done. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
I was recently speaking with multimedia producer Lori Howell, and she observed there's been a shift on the labels of packaging. We've switched from what's in it to what's not in it. You know, fat-free, gluten-free, contains no peanuts, nor was it processed in an environment which also processes peanuts. It struck a chord with me, so I quizzed my cupboards. Sure enough, one way or another, half the packages proclaim the features of what wasn't inside. From less fat to no fat, less sugar to no sugar, from no salt to low salt, or lower salt, and you want to ask, lower than what? To no dyes and no fragrances, to the bag of air-popped popcorn, which gave top billing to the banner, Reduced Guilt. I opened the bag immediately to see what guilt I could find lurking around the edges. To do a thorough investigation, I had to add salt. I'm afraid it had reduced sodium as well. For years, packaging touted what was inside as delicious or nutritious, or both. And then there were the qualities you could count on if you purchased the product. The so-called promise factor, a more illusory offer which promised a pretty girl, a strong man, cute kids, or the perfect androgynous baby. Come on, I defy you to tell me the gender of the Gerber baby. And why do you think we need the clues of pink and blue? At some point we went through the additive phase, as in vitamin A added, vitamin C added, all manner of vitamins and minerals added, all you need for 10%, 50%, 100% of your daily vitamin requirement. An obvious marketing ploy to get you to eat the product every day. I always wondered what you were supposed to do once you got your 100% before 8 a.m. Stop eating anything else for the rest of the day? And could you overdose on a vitamin? Maybe you shouldn't have 2 bowls of that cereal. That would be 200%. Is that a bad idea? No matter what marketing is put on the outside of the package, food labels are required. They tell us what's in the product as a whole, from calories to fiber to vitamins, etc. And we have ingredients lists, where the order starts with the greatest amount and ends with the least. And now we have packaging telling us what's not there. Well, almost. The FDA ban on trans fat requires that by 2018, no product may contain trans fat where it does not occur naturally. And when the FDA bans something, I listen. We've all seen the occasional contains no trans fat message on the outside of packages, but it's still there. Look at the ingredient label and check if partially hydrogenated oil is somewhere on the mysterious ingredient list. If you find it, you're looking straight down the barrel of trans fat. We've all been around long enough to know that the voluntary outside of the package messages are meant to get us to pick it up and not somebody else's product. Yet Lori's observation tells me a lot. The what's not there message says to me, we're catching up with all that stuff that was added, often for reasons like cost control, extended shelf life, and those favorites of many, salt or sugar cravings, and now it's all come home to roost. The what's not here phase may last for quite some time, Just what exactly isn't there? Well, that's bound to change with the times. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, it's Nobel Prizes Explained 2015. We'll hear from panel convener and finance and economics professor Ludwig Kinkerini from the University of San Francisco. He's invited Dr. Rebecca Gordon, a philosophy professor also from the University of San Francisco, to discuss the Peace Prize. For the prize in literature, we hear from UC Berkeley history professor Susanna Elm. Dr. Darvin Scott Smith, the chief of infectious disease and geographic medicine at Kaiser Permanente in Redwood City, tells us about the Nobel in Physiology or Medicine. While Stanford University professor and Hoover Institution fellow Michael Boskin discusses the prize in economics. UCSF professor emeritus Jim Cleaver, currently with UCSF's Comprehensive Cancer Center, describes the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, and UC Berkeley physics professor Dr. Yasunori Nomura enlightens us about the prize in physics. I started Nobel Prizes Explained 2015 with its convener, USF professor Ludwig Kinkerini. Well, welcome back, Professor Kinkerini, and my wonderful panel here on Nobel Prizes.
Great to be here.
Now, Ludwig, this is your third panel that you have assembled for Nobel Prizes. Tell us where you got the idea and tell us how it works. It's just not like we'll just call up the department and say, send somebody over from physics, right?
That's right. Well, it started just as a way to inform the general public about what's going on. These are very difficult subjects and important for people to understand. And so that's how it started. And we're very fortunate that we live in the Bay Area because we have some really good schools here. And some top-notch research. I mean, some of these people could win the Nobel themselves.
Wouldn't that be great?
It would be great. It might happen in that way in the following years.
You guys all promise, you gals and guys all promise to come back if you win a Nobel Prize.
Guaranteed.
Guaranteed.
For one-on-one. That would be one.
That would be good.
Yeah, and it's hard to get people to come. So I'm amazed.
Not because they don't want to be here.
I would say, we're supposed to be positive on this show, right? I would say it's several things. It's one, people are very busy. You know, all these people are extremely busy, have a lot of things to do. Also, this prize specializes, and so many people don't even know what to say about that particular prize. So it's hard to find the right person. So it's difficult. It's difficult. But I'm very happy with what we have this year. We have some phenomenal people this year. It's amazing, actually.
I thought what we'd start with is the Nobel Peace Prize and Rebecca Gordon, Professor of Philosophy from USF. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here. So this year's Peace Prize actually went to a very important organization. It's in the little country, the little North African country of Tunisia, the National Dialogue Quartet, which is a group of organizations in what's called civil society in Tunisia, two labor unions, a human rights organization, and an organization of attorneys, of lawyers. What they did is really important. You may recall that in 2011, the world observed this extraordinary uprising all over North Africa and in the greater Middle East that we call now the Arab Spring. And out of all the countries that rose up and whose people said, we are tired of this corrupt authoritarian government that we are living under, only one, Tunisia, today has a secular democratic constitution and has had a successful transition to a true democracy. And there are a couple of reasons for that, but one of the key reasons was that at one particular moment when everything could have gone south, this quartet of organizations stepped in and helped to negotiate a peaceful solution to a very serious problem, which was that after the dictator, whose name was Zine Ben Ali, was thrown out of Tunisia, what was put in place, elections were held, and a somewhat moderate Islamist party won the election. But as happened also in Egypt, people began to chafe under that government. They were about to throw that party out. And this is the point at which we could have seen true civil war. At that moment, it was this quartet who negotiated a peaceful transition to a technocratic kind of government, followed by the writing of a constitution, elections to parliament, to a parliament in 2014, followed by presidential elections. There's one other thing I'd like to say about this, which is that there are a number of reasons why Tunisia was able to do this. A lot of them have to do with Tunisia itself. The fact that it's largely a homogeneous population as concerns religion, so that while it's about 98% Muslim, almost all of those folks are Sunni. In addition, it had a long tradition of organized workers, organized students, organized women's organizations that had been participating in civil society even under the dictatorship. In some ways, though, the most important reason, I would say, is that unlike Egypt, Libya, Iraq, Syria, they did not have a whole lot of U.S. intervention. And when you
Do we
look,
get the anti-peace prize?
Well, you know, this October, we actually got to watch one Nobel Peace Prize winner bomb the hospital of another Nobel Peace Prize winner when Barack Obama's army bombed and destroyed the Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders Hospital in Kunduz in Afghanistan. So, yeah, the United States' role in what has happened in Libya, in what has happened in Bahrain, where the United States took the side of the king and took the side of Saudi Arabia, what's happened in Yemen, and worst of all, what we're seeing today in Syria. In all of these cases, we have a situation in which the U.S. played, unfortunately, a very strong role.
But back to Tunisia.
Yes.
First of all, that the United States was not involved, as we like academics like to say, was possibly correlative but not causative.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I'm merely observing.
Didn't happen to be there. Not necessary. Not
right.
A necessary element. We don't have to go make democracy everywhere. The second part of that was what was important under the dictator, that like minds, like skills could get together, and that was in place even though the government was coming down. So if they stop like-minded people coming together, you really have a problem.
Absolutely. And so it's important to know a little bit about the kind of dictatorship that Tunisia was. And it was not a totalitarian state, but essentially the main gripe that people had against Ben Ali was not even his authoritarian rule. It was corruption. And this is something that we actually see around the world, that very often the thing that finally brings people into the streets is the sense that their government is stealing very directly from the people. And sometimes – and so what happened, for example, with Mohamed Bouazizi, who was the young man who was a vegetable seller whose suicide touched off the Arab Spring, what had happened to him was he'd been in the marketplace with his cart of vegetables. He hadn't paid a bribe to a policeman or a policewoman, actually. The policewoman had confiscated his cart and had slapped him in the face in the process of doing this. And it was that final insult, that sense that everywhere you turned, the system was corrupt, that led him to finally commit suicide out of despair.
You're listening to Tech Nation and Nobel Prizes Explained 2015. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are USF Finance and Economics Professor Ludwig Kinkerini, USF Philosophy Professor Rebecca Gordon, UC Berkeley History Professor Susanna Elm, Kaiser Permanente's Dr. Darvin Scott-Smith, Stanford University Economics Professor Michael Boskin, UCSF Professor Emeritus Jim Cleaver, and UC Berkeley physics professor Yasunori Nomura. Now let's go to literature, and let's welcome Dr. Susanna Elm. She is a UC Berkeley professor in the Department of History and Classics. Welcome, Susanna.
Thank you very much. And yes, I'm a historian, and I'll come back to that. Now, the Nobel Prize in Literature this year was awarded to Svetlana Alexievich for, and I quote, her polyphonic writings, a monument to suffering and courage in our time. What does that mean? Svetlana Alexievich was born in the Ukraine in 1948 to a Ukrainian mother and a Belarusian father. And she grew up in Belarus, Minsk primarily. And that means that she was actually born, of course, in one of the republics of the former Soviet Union, the USSR. And that has been an absolutely important red thread to her work. Svetlana Alexievich is a journalist, an investigative journalist, and she writes something that has caused a little bit of a raising of eyebrows in the commentators, among the commentators, because what she actually writes is not fiction. What she does and why it is called polyphonics is she assembles interviews. She goes and interviews people time and again, time and again. So it's kind of almost like a documentary form of journalism or a documentary form of almost like documentary photography in written form, where she lets her subjects, if you wish, speak. Then she takes those interviews, goes back, intensified, condenses these interviews, and brings them out in a collage. So nothing in there really, in the books that she has written, and I'm kind of emphatic on the word written, is really her own words. But what she does is she brings to the fore what she calls the emotional history of an enormously important time. So people have said, well, if you do not write fiction, how can that be an award in literature? But in some ways, of course, that is entirely beside the point. Number one, yes, it is factual, if you wish. But to bring that out, to put it together, is very it's very much like literature in many ways, because you can have questions whether or not fiction can bring to the fore the horrors of the past century, the horrors of the 20th century. As you may know, people have said, Paul Celan, for example, that you can no longer write fiction after the Holocaust. And in some ways, that is also what Svetlana Alexievich is engaged in, this project of bringing to the fore the whole spectrum of the experience in the Soviet Union before and after 1989. And she does this in this absolutely amazing way. Now, as I was saying, she basically lived for a very long time in Belarus, and she has returned to Belarus, to Minsk. But Belarus, as you may be well aware of, is being run, really, by a dictator by the name of Lukashenko. And Lukashenko was unhappy about having an investigative journalist like her in his country, as you may imagine. And she left, she went into exile and lived, for example, in Berlin, among many other places. She left in 2001 and then returned in 2011 to Minsk because she says, and it's clear after what I just said, that she cannot do her work unless she can listen. So she's absolutely, of course, required to be in amongst her peers and to be able to listen in her own language. That is the essence of what she does in her work. Now, I heard her speak after she had won the Peace Prize of the German Book Trade in 2013 for a work which has not yet been translated into English. It is called Secondhand Time. That would be a literal translation. And in that work, she chronicles voices of persons who have come of age in the Soviet Union and then had to struggle with, of course, you know, what happened afterwards, Glasnost and all the rest of it. And I read that book in part because myself working on the later Roman Empire, clearly I'm interested in the decline and fall of empires, right? I mean, then we always
any
want
empire.
To know any empire.
You better decline and fall, Susanna.
They
right
will
there.
Decline and fall sooner or later, right? I mean, that seems just to be the fate of empires. And so I was really, really interested in reading what people were saying. And if you read this, once you read this, you will, I think, gain a much better understanding for what Putin is doing, or rather why somebody like Putin is as popular in the former Soviet Union as he is now. At least this is what I think. Others might know more about it. Now, her portrays, therefore, then, because they gather so many different voices, and I call them portrays of peoples and events, are very nuanced, are very finely tuned. So the important point to keep in mind is that the Nobel Prize for Literature is also up to a certain point political, right? And clearly, at this juncture, to give it to somebody from Belarus, Ukraine, etc., probably wasn't accidental. Nevertheless, the most important thing, I think, is that this is really a person, and this is what Nobel said in his testament, who shall have produced in the field of literature the most outstanding work in an ideal direction. Yes, she has, I think.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you. Now let's turn to Dr. Darvin Scott Smith. He's the chief of infectious disease and geographic medicine at Kaiser Permanente in Redwood City. And he's going to talk about the prize in physiology and medicine. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here. So this year's prize in medicine physiology went to three different people, and it was actually about medicines, two different drugs that are turning out to be very important over the last few decades, saving hundreds of millions of lives. So these prize winners, two of them helped to or actually developed and brought to people, humans, a drug called avermectin, later when it was used in humans, known as ivermectin. And William C. Campbell is from New Jersey, and then Satoshi Amura is from Japan. So each of them got a quarter of the prize for developing ivermectin, which is a really important antiparasitic drug used for most notably river blindness. And that
horrible disease
is a terrible disease that's caused untold suffering, mostly in Africa, but also in Latin America.
And if you could tell us about the symptoms and arc of river blindness.
Sure. So the symptoms, even though it's called river blindness, are actually worse than blindness, the itching that can drive people to suicide because this parasite gets under the skin. It's transmitted by a black fly along rivers in very fertile areas of Africa. And so it's really devastated economies there along, for instance, the Upper Volta River and so on. So this drug has had an enormous impact because it's changed our approach to prevention of the disease. And in fact, it used to be the case that we would go with fixed-wing airplanes and spray all these insecticides, try and get rid of the black flies. Well, now that this drug, a single drug, could treat one dose and it would last 6 months up to a year, you could actually get rid of the disease if you treat a population long enough, because then the parasites under the skin of these people would disappear and the flies would no longer transmit them. So their story was really interesting in that William Campbell was working with Merck Sharp and Dohme, and he was getting samples from Dr. Amura in Japan, who was collecting them from soil. And he had this amazing sort of way of codifying a methodology, really, to bring the chemistry of microbes to make them into medicinal or medicines that were of great value. So he, the funny part of this story, I remember hearing this in 1987 when this drug was made available to me when I was a researcher in Colombia in South America. But he collected this soil sample from a golf course near Tokyo. And it eventually was noticed to, you know, have properties that would kill roundworms. The roundworms are what cause a variety of human infections. And later, after being used for quite a number of years in farm animals for agricultural production, increasing production, was tested in humans and found to be very effective, very benign. It doesn't cause many side effects, and was used broadly for a whole bunch of different things. Filaria, which is also a mosquito-borne illness, the river blindness I mentioned, but ectoparasites, a great number of parasitic diseases.
All from a golf course.
All from this golf course, a soil sample. So and anyway, they collaborated from afar, and they each contributed very unique parts. Dr. Omura has two PhDs, one in chemistry and one in pharmacy, that really informed the methodology that brought this this medicine to attention. And in fact, that medicine, like the other medicine I'll tell you about in a moment, is on the WHO list of essential medicines because it's so important to humanity. So the other half of the prize was awarded to Tu Youyou, who is a Chinese researcher, and she discovered artemisins, which are anti-malarial drugs. It's a drug that she actually was able to find, isolate, and describe based on her research. And this is fascinating. It was a very different approach for a Nobel Prize in medicine because she looked at ancient texts in China and went out and on this very peripatetic expedition found and talked to, interviewed, and collated information about folk medicine. And then she became known to the party in China in the 60s and was selected, in fact, to a secret investigative group called the 523 in 1967.
Wow.
In order to try and cure malaria, because this is a big problem with Chinese soldiers in Vietnam in the 60s. There was this little conflict going on. And so she was part of that group as a woman in 67, initiating with her background, having gone through the countryside and sort of collected this data. And she then was able to work in the lab and to isolate the chemical that was later known as artemisin and is an essential component of anti-malarial treatments today. But the other couple of things that she did that were very unique and interesting, she tested this chemical, the artemisin, in mice and demonstrated clearly in mice and then monkeys that it got rid of malaria. And later, the whole purpose of this, of course, for humans, she tested on herself and she took samples. She didn't give herself malaria to test it, but to ensure safety, she ingested it.
She was her own phase one study.
She was her own,
okay,
her own human subject. And I mean, like other Nobel Prize winners, Barry Marshall did the same thing, giving himself H. pylori. But she took this risk and demonstrated that it was very safe. And then later, it was, of course, tested in humans and found to be remarkably effective. And now it's used in combination with a variety of other antimalarials because it's so effective.
You are listening to Tech Nation and our program on Nobel Prizes Explained 2015. We'll talk more after a break. Coming up in the second half of our show on Nobel Prizes Explained 2015, more prizes and more perspectives from each of our professors. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation and Nobel Prizes Explained 2015. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are USF Finance and Economics Professor Ludwig Kinkerini, USF Philosophy Professor Rebecca Gordon, UC Berkeley History Professor Susanna Elm, Kaiser Permanente's Dr. Darvin Scott-Smith, Stanford University Economics Professor Michael Boskin, UCSF Professor Emeritus Jim Cleaver, and UC Berkeley Physics Professor Yasunori Nomura.
And now let's go to economics. We have Dr. Michael Boskin here, Professor of Economics at Stanford University, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and a former chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Welcome, Dr. Boskin.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here and among these colleagues talking about the other prizes as well. The Nobel Prize for Economics was awarded to Angus Deaton of Princeton University. He's a professor of economics and public affairs, international affairs at Princeton. Angus was born in Scotland. He has dual U.S. and British citizenship. He spent his early career at Cambridge, and his main advisor was also a Nobel laureate, previous Nobel laureate, Professor Richard Stone of Cambridge. And Angus went on to do important work in the areas that Richard Stone is known for best. So it was the most glorious thing, a professor seeing their star student actually improve what they had done. And I first met Angus many, many years ago in the late 1970s. We were both young assistant professors. We were both presenting papers at an International Economic Association meeting organized by Richard Stone. And so there were several of us going from different countries, and we agreed to meet in the Milan train station. I had never met Angus before, and so we got to know each other on the train from Milan to Urbino, Italy. If you have never been to Urbino, it's a charming Quattrocento town with a walled city.
And back then,
when the Russians sent somebody, the Soviets sent somebody, they traveled in threes. They traveled as the professor giving the talk, the KGB officer keeping an eye, so the first one didn't defect, and a second KGB guy keeping an eye on the first two. And they always ran down at every lunch break and after dinner, they ran down and bought everything that was – every consumer good they could in the piazza to take back. So it was an interesting beginning to a relationship. And Angus is a very popular and worthy choice for his work on consumption. Consumer spending is the bulk of most economies. It's about two-thirds of the American economy. China's an outlier. Even for a developing economy, it's under half of China's economy, and that's a big issue that the Chinese are trying to redress now. And consumption is the flip side of saving. If you think what you do with your income after you pay your taxes, you either spend it or you save it. And so decisions about how much you consume and how much you save are consequential both for the short-run performance of the economy and for the long run, because the way we improve the economy and grow the economy is by investment, which is financed by that saving, investment in machinery and software and buildings and so on, and by technological improvements which are embedded in this capital. So your new iPhone has a lot more stuff in it and a lot faster processor than your old Motorola from 10 years ago. So these are really, in that sense, fundamental to our understanding of the economy. And Angus was awarded the prize for three interrelated contributions in consumption, unlike some prizes which are given for one very specific thing. The first was his development with John Muehlbauer of what's called an almost ideal demand system. So Angus had a much more flexible, much more general representation that was also econometrically estimable with some finite amount of data. So that was a big improvement. That was around 1980. A decade later, he did a variety of studies questioning some of the basic work that had been done on consumption and income, the most famous of which at the time when he did this work in 1990 were the legacies of two previous Nobel laureates, Milton Friedman and Franco Modigliani, the permanent income hypothesis and the life cycle theory. To oversimplify, they said that people tended to smooth their consumption. If their income fluctuated, they didn't want it to go down a lot if their income fell, so it didn't go up quite as much. They saved more when their income went up, and they drew down that saving if their income fell, and so on. So they tried to get a relatively smooth consumption profile over time. And Angus showed that had certain problems. It turns out that, for reasons I won't get into here, that would predict that consumption would actually be more volatile than income. And he demonstrated – and that was not observed in the data. Actually, aggregate consumption is much less volatile than income. People, as I said –
I eat three meals a day, buddy.
Yeah, that's right. People tend to adjust their consumption more gradually. And he demonstrated that a big part of the problem was the relationship of individual behavior to the macroeconomic total. So, for example, again, to oversimplify, if you have an economy where half the people have their income grow 5% and another half have it shrink 3%, if you just look at a so-called representative consumer as representing the whole economy, you have one person, the representative consumer's income growing 2%. And it turns out when you take some of that disaggregated detail and then aggregate it up, it really is very revealing about the behavior of consumption. A third round of Angus's really important work was in development economics. So we've gotten microeconomics with the almost ideal demand system, macroeconomics with the relationship of consumption to income and what that means for business cycles and saving and long-term capital accumulation and economic growth. But Angus turned his attention to thinking about poverty and consumption in poor countries. And almost by definition, it's going to be very hard to measure income of people in many poor countries. The data are just very, very difficult to gather. People live in out in rural areas. They don't have advanced computer systems. People aren't paid with deposits, payroll deposit in their banks, et cetera. So it's very hard to get accurate income information, but it's easier to do household surveys and get information about what their spending patterns are and actually observe what they're spending money on. And Angus spent a lot of time exploiting that and demonstrating how you didn't even have to follow the same people over time. You could look at a cohort and follow them over time and make some very useful implications of what's going on. And that has had immense influence, not only in the economics profession, but in organizations like the World Bank and the United Nations in trying to measure poverty. Angus had a lot of ways he developed where you could get better information on local prices. It used to be we used to make comparisons across countries, including poor countries, looking at income per capita. But he did very detailed studies showing that you shouldn't just count a child like an adult. They consume a lot less. And you can get much more accurate if you get some equivalent scale to count children or successive children. And those kinds of insights have even been incorporated in official poverty measures, including the United States. So Angus has been very influential in that regard. And I want to conclude on a very optimistic note from the so-called dismal science. Angus turned his attention to writing about broad issues, incorporating his research, and wrote a book in 2013 in which he concluded that there's never been a time in human history that people have been doing better. It's important to understand that we have lots of problems. We have people that aren't doing well. We have lots of issues. We don't want to deny that. But there's never been a time where such a large fraction of the world's population has been relatively well off, and a decreasing fraction of the world's population lives in poverty, particularly abject poverty. And despite the disparities, health and life expectancy, all those things, on balance, have improved a lot, almost everywhere with some exceptions. And so I think that what you learn from Angus's work is the power of economics to objective economics, both theory and statistics and econometrics, and applying that to real-world problems can actually give us a more accurate representation of what's going on, of economic history, and a better basis for formulating economic policy.
Thank you. That was terrific. Now let's go to the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. And joining us is Dr. Jim Cleaver, Professor Emeritus at UCSF. That's the University of California, San Francisco, both the departments of dermatology and pharmaceutical chemistry. He's currently with the Comprehensive Cancer Center at UCSF. Welcome.
Thank you. Let me begin by reading a note which was received by a school teacher in London. It said, "Please give Maddie one more day to complete her homework. We had some big family news and did not get to this. Her grandpa won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry." Grandpa was Thomas Lindahl, a man that I've known for many years and very well respected in the field. He shared the Nobel Prize with two other workers in the field of DNA repair. Tom Lindahl is now the Emeritus Professor of the Francis Crick Institute in London. Paul Modrick, he is a Howard Hughes investigator, at Duke University, and Aziz Sanchar is a professor of biochemistry at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. All three have shared the prize for unraveling the detailed chemistry of DNA damage and DNA repair. And to give you some background to this, Tom Lindahl was the one who first formally realized that our DNA is living in a very precarious world. It is in our cells, but it's in an aqueous environment, it's in a high oxygen environment, it's subjected to ultraviolet light from the sun, ionizing radiation, X-rays, chemicals, chemotherapy agents. So it is a very unstable molecule. So he formally realized in the 70s there must be a way to stabilize and repair any of this damage. To give you an example, the melanomas and skin cancers are full of radiation-induced mutations from the sun. They're very, very much at risk from DNA damage. As another aside, cosmic rays are very deleterious. And a major problem which the space program has to face is that if we're going to send astronauts to Mars, how are their brains going to survive 2 or 3 years in space subjected to cosmic rays continually through that trip? So DNA damage is a very pressing concern. And the fundamental way in which damage gets repaired depends on the fact that our DNA has two strands. One is the complement of the other, so that if you lose something on one strand, you've retained the information on the other, and you can use that to patch the first. So whatever the kind of damage is, most of it can be repaired by what we call a cut and a patch. Very simply, enzymes will find the damage, cut and remove that damage, and then synthesize a brand new strand using the code on the opposite undamaged strand. So this cut and patch, in principle, occurs right through the biological kingdom, from bacteria to man. What is different is that each particular kind of damage has its own chemistry, and so it needs its own particular machinery to recognize and remove. Tom Lindahl identified how a single base that's damaged can get removed and patched. Paul Modrick identified how if a wrong base is in and we have a mismatch across, how that mismatch gets corrected. And Aziz Sanchar, he complements Tom Lindahl's work in a way in also showing detailed biochemistry of how a large damaged region of DNA gets recognized and removed. He also did some interesting work on what we call a photoreactivation system. And what this is if you irradiate a bacterium and you make ultraviolet damage, there's actually an enzyme which will allow you to shine visible light afterwards. The enzyme absorbs the visible light energy and turns around and corrects the damage. So it counts kind of like a little miraculous one-enzyme system. One of the interesting things about this whole world of DNA damage and repair is that it opens you up into worlds of evolution, mutation, cancer causation, cancer treatment, a whole array
of
things.
All cancers are caused by mutations in your cell.
That's right.
Whether you're born with them or it happened to you.
So, and in fact, the breast cancer genes, BRCA1, BRCA2, these are repair genes. These control the way in which damage gets repaired. And hence, because in patients that carry defective BRCA1 and 2 genes, they're at very high risk for getting breast cancer.
Because their tools to repair the DNA are compromised.
That's exactly right.
And these guys figured out what's going on in there and how the tools work.
Yes.
I'd give them a Nobel Prize. I might give them two.
In case one gets broken, they can repair it.
That's right.
They must have had some pretty high-tech gear to follow an electron. Is it worth talking about that for a second?
I can't go into it here, but it is there are physical methods for following the activation of electrons and their movement from the two. There are two antennae molecules in the photolayers that absorb the light. They move electrons across, and you can look at the oxidative state of these antennae molecules. Now, what excited me years back, as I was involved in this work and made the formal discovery or statement that the photoreactivation process is completely missing in human cells. And this was a long, long, heated argument. And it does turn out to be correct. And Aziz Anshar did the formal proof of purifying and isolating out of human cells and showed this enzyme doesn't occur there. It's not there at all. But there's a similar protein with the same similar structure, similar antennae, but it controls diurnal response. It controls our response to light. So it's the same kind of response to light, but instead of repairing, it keeps us in tune with day and night. So here's an interesting window. Now, if we can think now of practical applications, one of the things which the Swedish Academy mentioned was the impact of DNA repair for chemotherapy. Well, one of the compounds that's used in chemotherapy, cisplatin, is a DNA-damaging agent, and so are many other agents like that. And so this kind of approach, in fact, if you think of melanoma, which is induced by UV exposure, no repair system is 100% efficient. So if there is inefficiency in the repair, your melanocytes develop new mutations as a result of the damage and the inefficient repair. By making new mutations, melanoma cells now have new proteins on their surface, which make new targets for chemotherapy. And in fact, is immunotherapy now that is one of the up-and-coming treatment methods for melanoma.
Now, let me ask you this. Usually, I have scientists in here, and they're saying, we know if it's cancer, this protein is on the surface of the cell, and that's what we're going after. What you're telling me is we might be able to intentionally create particular proteins on the cell so we can go after them.
That's one possibility. And let me just pick an aside on a practical issue. Many of these become so individual that we're facing the problem of developing immunotherapy for individual targets that are different for each particular melanoma. So, and you can think about the problem financially of developing and targeting in this situation. So the health system may get more and more efficient, but more and more expensive.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Now let's go to physics. Dr. Yasunori Nomura. He is a professor of physics at the University of California, Berkeley, and a senior scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Welcome.
My pleasure.
Tell us about the Nobel Prize in Physics.
This year's Nobel Prize is about particles called neutrinos, very strange particles. And
I've never seen one myself.
Yeah, you can't see, actually. And it's given to Dr. Arthur McDonald in Canada and Dr. Takaaki Kajita in Japan. Neutrinos are pretty strange particles. They were first proposed by Wolfgang Pauli in 1930 in a letter directed to the conference in Tübingen in Germany. He did not write a paper, and he said, I do not write a paper. It was so strange. This was proposed to solve some problem, in some radioactive processes, like energy doesn't conserve and so on. He proposed, okay, there are some invisible guys like solving this.
We'll call them neutrinos.
Yeah, exactly. So people didn't like it. Oh, this is a cheap solution. Come on. Okay. In order to avoid, yeah, it must be light and it must not be interacting with us. I mean, okay, so what's the point? This neutrino has been attracting a lot of interest of the people. Because it's just strange. And in fact, it has been a Nobel Prize producer. And after neutrinos proposed, and neutrino was detected. That got the Nobel Prize. And detection was in 1956. And then the neutrino was discovered to have at least two species, different neutrinos. That was in 1962, and again got the Nobel Prize. Three people got Nobel Prize for that. And then neutrino was detected from the sky. For example, some supernova, it's the end of the star, it's exploding, or from sun. And these things, again, get another Nobel Prize. And the detection was 1987 from supernova and Orion from the sun. And now, again, this is Nobel Prize. Why? And what's
Why
the point of
this
time? Yeah, what's this time? What's a specific discovery? And this time, neutrino was discovered to have a mass. The point was that the neutrino was believed to be massless. The reason is that the neutrinos are pretty light compared with the other elementary particles, much, much, much lighter. And the natural possibility is, okay, so it's massless. In fact, that was something called the standard model of particle physics, and neutrino was massless. In order for neutrino to be massive, the theory told us that the neutrino mass changed the species while traveling in space. Yeah, it's just some species of neutrino called electron neutrino, muon neutrino, tau neutrino. We have three species. We know it's only three because of the experiment and so on. And these three species changes while it's just traveling.
While it's traveling.
Yes.
Yeah, over distance.
And this is a quantum mechanical effect. It's a weird thing. Some quantum mechanical is far from our own perception of a classical world, which we call classical world, something is there, then it's there. No quantum mechanical, probabilistically sometimes there, sometimes not there, something like that. That's how nature works at the deepest level. And this neutrino oscillation is a manifestation of that phenomenon. These people demonstrated that oscillation in experiment. For Kajira, it's called Super Kamiokande, and for Dr. McDonald, called SNOW, by clever experimental techniques.
That's why they got the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
Okay, so everybody gets 20 seconds. Okay. There's been a terrible thing. It's that somebody mismanaged, you know, Alfred Nobel's inheritance, and they're going to have to cut one of the prizes. They just don't have enough money to give out. Why should your prize stay? We'll start with the Peace Prize, Rebecca.
Well, I think the answer is obvious. If we don't have people working to prevent wars and to keep peace, none of the rest of the prizes even matter because there won't be any human beings to win them.
Very strong argument. Very strong argument. Yes, Dr. Elm with literature.
Well, given that we still have human beings, we want to know how human beings think and feel. And almost nobody can give us that better, more concise, more persuasively than those who write about us, i.e. those who write literature.
Very good. Dr. Boskin, economics.
Well, I have the easiest answer because the economics Nobel Prize is not funded by Alfred Nobel.
Oh, I forgot to. But he's got the
state.
Same.
It's funded by money. It's funded by the Swedish Central Bank.
I know, but they called in. They lost all their money too.
I think it would be a shame if any of them were had to be cut. I would propose maybe smaller stipends rather than cutting one out. But in any event, because that would cause such a war among the different disciplines that it would be unpleasant. And we do want peace among the different disciplines.
Peace among the disciplines.
So I would say, however, that improving our understanding of the economy is really important. And in some ways, it's just as complex as what was just described about physics and chemistry and medicine. Even harder in some sense because we're trying to understand human behavior, which has many, many dimensions which are not as easily reducible to mathematics. Some of it is probabilistically, but I think it's very, very important.
Okay, let's see. Where do we go next? We go to medicine.
So I think the Nobel Prize in Medicine, Physiology is absolutely essential and as the most important because it's really reduced human suffering in huge measurable ways. Hundreds of millions of people with neglected disease, the poorest of the poor throughout the world. Billions of people are affected by these medicines that have become available over the last couple, three decades. So clear winners and for great, very good reasons.
Great. Dr. Scott Smith, thank you. And now chemistry, Dr. Jim Cleaver.
Yes, I think maintaining our stable DNA is fundamental to life itself and has important practical applications in many aspects of human health.
Dr. Nomura, tell us physics. Why?
I'm glad to see that this year's prize was awarded for fundamental science. That's not useful immediately to people. It may be in someday in a big way. But this is for fundamental physics. That's crucial. Why we do music, why we do painting, why we do... We have to be curiosity-driven. That define us human. That's exactly what Nobel wanted, I guess. And physics, the fundamental physics, is really manifesting that kind of human's endeavor. And it's pretty crucial to be including that as a Nobel Prize.
The last word to our convener, Dr. Ludwig Cingarini.
I think it's fun, but one thing I think is that all these great people would do the work without the Nobel Prize. I actually believe that. And the last thing I'm really thinking about, and I'll probably wonder about it tonight, is what it would be like to live your life as a neutrino. That's really what I'm trying to figure out.
Thank you so much, everyone. We really appreciate it. Please
Thank
come
you.
Back and see us.
You are listening to Tech Nation and Nobel Prizes Explained 2015. Explaining the Peace Prize, Dr. Rebecca Gordon, a professor of philosophy at the University of San Francisco. Describing the prize in literature, UC Berkeley history professor Susanna Elm. For the Nobel in Physiology and Medicine, Dr. Darvin Scott Smith, the chief of infectious disease and geographic medicine at Kaiser Permanente in Redwood City. The prize in economics was discussed by Stanford University professor and Hoover Institution fellow Michael Boskin. UCSF Professor Emeritus Jim Cleaver, currently with UCSF's Comprehensive Cancer Center, described the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. And UC Berkeley Physics Professor Dr. Yoshinori Nomura enlightened us about the prize in physics. A special thanks to panel convener and finance and economics professor Ludwig Cingarini from the University of San Francisco. This has been Nobel Prizes Explained 2015. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcourt.